This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Not nice. Only shows part of it.
Honestly, I'm working on the real three. Is actually up there right now. So
we'll come and we'll squeeze in there with you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very strange to watch it with you because you're literally our first audience. We've never seen it in a room full of people before.
Really?
Yeah. We've been living in the editing room, so yeah.
So this isn't one of those films that's going to go through the test screening process.
Thank God it's not.
Yeah. How do you avoid that?
Well, I think we just ran out of time. I think we ran out of time, and just I'm actually glad we're not.
It's such a big movie to cut that I think we felt like rather than rush it through when we were wanting to take time with it, you know, the last thing you want to do after you spend so much time prepping and shooting a movie is rush it through post.
So we just locked on runtime, or
we're like right now we're 152, 153, 1 hour 52 minutes, somewhere around there. But yeah, so we're just tweaking and working on things, and obviously the first two reels and the second reel alone has a lot of choices and stuff, so we're finally honing in on all that stuff, but we're excited.
It's all, a lot of it hand cameras from, you guys use any of the Shield crew?
I didn't use the Shield crew, but it's definitely Shield influence, you know. And in a weird way, as great as all the Bourne movies are and stuff, everyone's like, "Oh, that's so great." I'm like, "Oh, we were doing that on the Shield 9 years ago."
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's so great about that, but we do. But I wanted to go a little bit handheld, but not, you know. I think there's a tendency now to abuse a handheld camera just to have it. So we just wanted to be in there and sort of feel like we're documenting it properly without being crazy. And a lot of that, believe it or not, for my first time in my career, is Steadicam. I found the Steadicam operator that I love that kind of makes it have sort of a handheld feel. So a lot of what you're seeing, particularly on the ground and the walking, is Steadicam. It just has a handheld feel to it, which I kind of like.
It's also got a very practical feel. I mean, whether or not you've got some blend of CGI and a lot of practical effects work, I mean, all of the car stuff that's going on there feels very visceral.
Well, yeah, the thing is, you know, because I think it's sort of a combination of both. All those cars that you see getting crunched are cars getting crunched. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the one thing that if there's digital in there, it's basically removing the cables that are help us yanking the cars mm-hmm. into one another. So it's all practical based with CG elements. And so this, when you have a CG element, like there's particularly a couple of the crane shots and things like that we're working on, when they're not done well, and they have, you know, you have to have a high standard because our movie is not like a Transformers where you sit there and marvel at how amazing it is. That, you know, it hopefully has to go by in a naturalistic way, which I think makes visual effects that much harder.
Yeah.
You know? I think so. Also, movies like Transformers can exist in a totally heightened world. You know, it's our world, but it's kind of a cartoon. Mm-hmm. This movie does not exist in that world at all. And, you know, that's why a lot of the choices were made to keep it just feeling grounded. You know, mm-hmm. that's why we ultimately felt like, you know, the shaky cam thing or whatever you want to call it. We just wanted to feel like you were there.
When I first met these guys and we started talking about it, you know, I don't know if I said to them, I feel like the French Connection when I read the script. I don't know what you guys felt when you read it. I said, to me, this is the French Connection. It just so happens that technology is sort of immersed in it.
When you said that, we were like, that's it.
Because we just wanted it to be as real and naturalistic as possible and so that the technology it's real. It's, you know, Alex, I said, like, at the end of this movie, you want people to fear their BlackBerry. I think that's
right. This movie has had, you guys have been pretty good at keeping the secrecy about what the film's about and everything else. So what's was that an intentional thing from the very beginning? I mean, how's that been with the studio, you know?
I think in general, just Steven, no matter, even if it doesn't have to be secretive, it's just got a thing where he just loves for the plot to sort of stay fresh and to actually see it. But I think it's a little bit of both. It's one of those things where as the story unfolds, and it's not like there's this great sort of aha moment where you go, oh my God, I get it. But I think you just keep working and working at this movie. And I think if you knew where the movie was going eventually, it might not be as an enjoyable of experience because you want the audience to keep working to figure it out. And even as things unfold and we get to act three, you're still trying to figure out exactly what's happening. You know, the first movie I made, Salt and Sea, sort of had that feel. You didn't really know what the hell was going on or what it felt like. And to me, it was one of those sort of unconventional story strengths in a way. And I feel like we have that strength as well. You just have to sort of keep working and trying to figure it out. And when you think you're on it, it's not exactly what it is. And it's not like there's uber twists or anything like that. But this movie makes you work. And actually, it's a lot more plot heavy than you would think, just from, particularly as, you're always wrestling as a director, character versus plot. And I found that a lot of that was happening in this movie a lot, which I think is a good thing.
Well, it's interesting, because as a writer, you say character is plot. and you have to tie those two together, otherwise they feel so divided and the audience is kind of like, well, I'm seeing one thing but feeling another thing. And that's right. I think it was very important for us.
You want the audience to be subjectively at the same place as your main characters.
Yeah.
So the less they know, the more they really are experiencing it exactly as the main characters in the movie are experiencing.
And I think even the greatest video games, I think, are the one you're going around totally. A corner and you have no idea. And I think that's kind of I always feel like the first two reels, in a way, are like you know level two of it of a great video. Do you know what I mean? Where you're just like, okay, I'm going to go around this corner. Okay, what do I do now? Okay, go do this. And so eventually, you're going to have to start to take control. And I think that's what our characters decide to do is, as the movie progresses and they're being led around, they have no choice and they're trying to get out of this, is that they try to get some control. And I think that's what makes the movie fun. It is sort of a big video game.
That point of view, I think, is also borrowed a lot from Hitchcock. You know, it's like this feels very much like, you know, when you're watching a Hitchcock movie, you, for most of the movie, are playing the guessing game of, like, what's the end game, what's the plot, how are these people involved in it? And it felt very much like we had to... It's the best way to tell the story. Just as a viewer, when you're sitting in the theater, that's what you want to experience. You know?
And also, you know, the interesting thing with that is it's not always necessarily the who, and I think which is just as important to me in this film is the why.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as you discover that, the who, you might discover who the who is, and then try and understand why it's happening is also as intriguing as the who.
The writing process on this, because you're not showing exactly how Big Brother or whatever is taking control of this equipment, does it make it easier? Like, unlike Enemy of the State, an example, like they really show you how they're doing it. Does it just make the process easier for the writing process?
Not in the least bit. No, because it all has to make sense retroactively when you see it at the end of the day. So everything, it's not random. You can't just do random things. They'll actually have to add up, hopefully.
So we will be shown.
Backwards?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. This movie was unbelievably hard to construct because... You know, you can come up with, like, really cool scene ideas, yeah. but at the end of the day, you end up hitting the eject button on half of them because they don't pay off in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they don't pay off in the right way, then you can't, you just have to, let it go. So there was a very long process. I mean, you know, again, this was, I think, part of why, you know, Stephen had this idea 10 years ago and it's taken some time to get going is because it's one of those things that if you do it right, it's really complicated and you're going to have to go through many, 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 many drafts to get the architecture right.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think that's why. So, exactly what Bob's saying, it's like you can have a cool scene idea. I mean, Enemy of the State's different too, in that it's asking you to step outside the characters a lot. You know, technology was like really new at the time, mm-hmm. and like, you know, surveillance equipment. And this isn't, you know, weirdly, it's not a movie that's really about surveillance equipment or who's manipulating the surveillance equipment. It's really about these people and this problem and how they get out of it.
You reference The French Connection, which is. At the end of the day, a very small movie, but both the most recent trailer and the opening suggest that this is going to go pretty broad in scope. What sort of balance do you have between that kind of tight feel?
I think it's really the characters that keep it in that tight feel and sort of the naturalistic way. You'll see, you know, particularly when you see Chicago and we go to Indianapolis and the story kind of progresses to D.C., it's not sort of your postcard DC and your postcard Chicago, and everything you saw in Chicago, well, I should say 99% of what you saw in Chicago was all natural lighting. We just took, if we saw a sodium vapor, we actually had a sodium vapor copied and maybe had it in here for a little bit of fill light, but we were running and gunning, and there's my favorite thing about this is it's four shots in this movie that are from our location scout, where we just brought a little Airy 3 with us and started to roll film on some of the trains, and those are in the final movie.
Cool.
And so we wanted to get that's sort of the French Connection feel, man, just the grit, you can taste it, and get in Shia's neighborhood. You know, I think, you know, you see a lot of films where you popcorn films are in Chicago, and it's all about the postcard Chicago. And this is a completely different neighborhood that's now a Latino neighborhood that was a Polish neighborhood, and the hallway that you see there is that thin and narrow, and I don't know, there's just something about the texture of it. And when I say French Connection, I think they're really key. And as far as the scope, and yeah, the movie opens up a little more and gets a little bit bigger, but I think it's the two characters that really keep it contained.
Is this meant to be R or?
It's hopefully going to be PG-13.
Yeah,
it'll be.
And after seeing Batman, I'm not that concerned about it. I kept doing this to my daughter. And I'm like, oh, shit, my wife is going to kill me.
Now,
I don't know, the knife in the mouth and stuff. It's like, I mean, it's great stuff, but it's intense. I mean, it's...
The pencil.
Yeah, yeah, and the pencil, my God. Great, great gag. We're talking about the pencil.
The best gag.
Well, then, are we meant to be aware that in, like, in these massive car accidents, all these people are potentially dying?
Who died?
No, actually,
it's a great question, because what you do is, what I realized was, in preparing the film, was that if you don't, it inhibits your action. Like, you can't shoot great action if you worry about people dying. And when you get to the end of the movie, you'll sort of understand why it's okay for some of those people to die. No, we're not sitting there and harping on it, but actually, you know, there's a body count that's sort of adding up at the end of this film, and you'll realize at the end of the day there's a purpose for that, and that they're, you know, I don't want to say collateral damage, but in a way that's part, it's all part of a bigger plan, and if you have to sacrifice some lives.
Is it easier for Bob and Alex to be working on a film like this and not have the fanboys breathing down your neck like Star Trek or Transformers? Not having a...
You two are involved with Transformers and Star Trek?
It's just a different experience. I mean, I think that we love, love, love doing those movies because we are fanboys. But it's really nice to step outside of that and work with someone like DJ and do a movie that feels like it's grounded in a different kind of reality. You know, it's really fun for us. I mean,
the flip side is we don't get any ideas from fanboys, so we don't get the extra help that we get. Actually, you know, chatting online with people, and, oh, that's a good idea. Right.
When you're filming a film like this on location, and how is it for improvising on the set, or is this a kind of film where you're more sticking to the script?
I think, you know, my style has always been to give the actors the freedom. As long as the words are working in a way and they're making the story and the scenes still have the same meaning and the intent, and we go through a pretty extensive rehearsal process where we don't necessarily lock lines down, but we lock our heads and we decide, like, this is what the scene is about to you. This is what that scene is about to you. And if the words change along the way, you know, and these guys are great about that, we're cool. And Shia, you know, and I could probably in Transformers as well, yeah, and Disturbia, it's like, he can turn it into gold. I mean, he can give you the same intent of the dialogue on the page. It's not quite sounding right and organic, and turn it into something gold. I think that's his greatest gift to filmmakers.
Definitely.
And again, we worked with a lot of cool writers in this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we went through kind of everyone brought a different thing to it, so...
And the problem when you have someone like Shia, though, is the other actors see that, and then they think that they can actually do the same thing.
Yeah, by the way, that's actually, it's a great point. There are very few actors who are really, really good at truly improvising. I mean, that's a real skill, you know, to be a really good improviser, and to make something funnier, and to make something sexier, and to make something all the different qualities, that's a very tough thing to do. And Shia just makes it look easy because he is that guy, you know. So when we went through the same process on Transformers 2 that we went through on Eagle Eye, you know, you sit in a room for like 3 days, just go through every scene, you start working through it, you kind of figure out, well, I like the idea of the line, but the way I'm saying it doesn't feel like how I'd say it, and you just end up rewriting. It's very, very organic, very easy to do with it.
So do you have a secret side deal with Shia that you're only going to work with him? Have you guys worked it out?
Honestly, I will. I mean, I will. Honestly, it's a blessing every day because he comes to work, and, you know, he just gives you 110%. And he, in a way, he almost tortures himself because he wants to be good. And he's never, I mean, there's never a day when it's the smallest thing. If he's only there for half a day and he's picking up a Coke can, it's like he's so committed. And, like, it's infectious. The crew, everybody, he loves him. And there's not anybody on the crew that he knows everybody's name, who everybody is, and he makes you love your job. So, of course, I'd work with a guy like that.
Yeah, we're trying to get legal custody of him now.
So, DJ, so why The Last Man is going to be happening then?
It's probably going to be happening, yeah. What happened is New Line is now part of Warner Brothers, and so Warner Brothers is very high on the project, and Carl Ellsworth, we're probably going to deliver the script to Warner Brothers / New Line next week. I think we finally licked it, so it's good.
So you're ready for the pressure you get from the fanboys?
Oh, I'm all ready for it, man. Bring it on. I love it.
So you got directing
hand
of last season of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I didn't get to because I was doing this, unfortunately. And I will tell you, because I know that, because Chicky obviously is in this movie, how you saw him in the beginning. The last episode,
that's what I heard,
is unbelievably explosive.
It's
so explosive, it's fantastic. You know, it's sort of a dream. It's sort of what I think The Sopranos should have been at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's fantastic.
It's going down.
It's good. It's really good.
So what... Oh, I was going to ask what you guys are actually writing as we speak, or are you working on Transformers 2 every day? What's the story?
We went through... We broke a good part of this... Basically, the whole story before the strike. And then they were able to prep off an outline we'd written during the strike. And then the second the strike ended...
It was great because I was seeing previs.
Yeah,
I was seeing previs from their outline on Eagle Eye set. So
it was cool. It was very cool. Yeah. And the second it ended, Bay was like, you know, we're locking you in a room for 2 months until we have a script. So
I didn't see you guys for a while.
Yeah, it was nuts. We literally lived in a room with Aaron Kruger, the three of us. And we finished the script, and then they were shooting it like 3 weeks later. So it was just insane.
Yeah, we won't come back into that probably until post, in terms of writing. just because, you know, once we're animating the robots again, you can change stuff and decide other stuff later.
Well, I was also curious what you guys are actually writing as we speak now.
Right now we're polishing up the 20th Amendment. It's a thriller that we wrote years back, and we might be able to get going again.
And Fringe. We've been doing Fringe.
And Fringe.
Some small show on Fox.
The teasers and the advertising and stuff on Fringe are like,
I know. Yeah, great job. Amazing.
The choice not to show much to, you know, we're kind of expecting to see something at Comic-Con for Eagle Eye. Was that a choice?
You know, I just thought, and I mean, I hate to say, like, this movie comes out September 26th. I really feel like I'm going to finish it on September 12th.
Yeah.
I mean that. It's just one of those things. I don't know how it happened, but it just happened. You know, it just sort of.
It's just because it's enormous.
It's enormous. It's bigger than I thought. And so that's why I just thought, you know, talk to Amy about it and look, what's the best thing we can do? And we just thought, like, hey, let's come to Amblin and check out where we are and see it. So that's it. I really wanted to go down, though, too. So.
And does this ever let up? Because this first, you know, 35 minutes is just... you don't get a chance to catch your breath.
Relentless. It's funny, because it's funny that you say that 35 minutes. I was like, guy, I hope the first act isn't too slow.
No, when you see it so much, you know what I mean.
Because when it gets going, it's like, it's a bullet to the end, you know. But yeah, I mean, we've been living it in the editing room.
It's pretty much that, you know what I mean? But there's some, you know, again, there's some nice scenes and some great character stuff that happen. It's action with incidents, so it's always happening, and you're always learning about people as it happens. We don't stop the story.
Will we see any more of the characters' lives before this happened to them, or is it just going forward now?
You're going to be propelled forward, and you will get a little bit of a look back into Shia's life particularly, mm-hmm. into Jerry's life, and to kind of get a little bit of understanding and stuff. And we delve a little bit in the past, but mostly you get a little bit of Jerry, you know, towards the end of Act 2. You'll get a little bit of where he is and where he came from.
I think, too, that, you know, these kinds of movies are always best when it's like a character is forced to confront whatever their character flaws are by attrition. You know, it's like they're forced into a situation where you've got basically 24 hours to face your worst demons in a time when you never thought you would have to do that. And that's part of what makes these movies good. So I think a lot of it is about both of them kind of seeing their lives from a new perspective because they're thrown into the insanity that they're thrown into.
You mentioned that Steven had come up with this about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. How similar is this film to what he originally told you about when he originally pitched it to you?
You were there before me. So
I mean, the kernel of what he pitched us was, what if the world turns against you in every way that it can when everything is so interconnected? So that's essentially what we ran with.
Yeah, what if all the technology that's there to make your life easier were able to be manipulated by someone and turn against you, and then it could turn you into someone that you don't want to be? And that felt like a very cool way to kind of come.
And I always, obviously, if you look back at the body of work, you know, with Kubrick and Steven, there's always been this fascination with man and machines and the love of machines, but also the machines as children and what happens when your children misbehave. So I think there's sort of a running thread in their work. And I think you can see, you know, if someone said to me, and I was, a fan sitting there, Steven Spielberg came up with a story, I'd go, absolutely. Yeah, I get it.
So we have to let these guys get back to work. You guys asked a couple last questions.
As the film's progressing, can audiences like catch on to clues that might give them answers later on, or when by the time you get to the third act?
Sure. Oh no, absolutely! You definitely can catch on to clues that would definitely, and they're there, and like again, they're all sort of. It's sort of like they're not sort of intentionally planted so that you can figure it out. But if you believe me, because we've unpeeled this movie many times, if you start to go back and track it, you'll understand.
Out of all the scenes that we saw, what was the most difficult to film?
Obviously the car chase, you know, just because it's all these different pieces and just trying to get it right, and also trying to keep it organic. And what I loved about this car chase in particular is that our two characters are meeting each other for the very first time.
Yeah.
And that these two worlds collide, and so as they're trying to figure each other out, they're in the middle of all this and the mayhem. So obviously that was very difficult to film. And also the opening sequence with Chiklis in the Pentagon. It was also just sort of a tough scene just to get all the beats and to do it right and to figure it out. And, you know, that's one of those scenes in one of the movies like this. Like, oh, you do that in a day. Go ahead, just do that in a day. Okay, great, sure, we'll do that in a day.
Obviously, that location's supposed to be in the Middle East. Is there a specific place?
Baluchistan.
Can you spell that?
No. No, but I'm sure my daughter can. No, I can't.
All right, thank you guys so much for coming. Thank